Well, here we are, the next hit in our series. Have we got the Behold Your King? Is that a slide you guys have got up there? I don't know if you have. I didn't send it through. I don't know if there's one on. Nah. Last week, I don't know if you remember, Tony had up on the screen the title for our series, Behold Your King. Often when there's a speaker, my mind goes in different places. And I don't know whether your mind was going anywhere there as well, but it got me thinking about the concept of kingship. And the punctuation, you know, there was no punctuation, behold your king. And in my head, I'm thinking through, oh, okay, is it behold your king, as in behold, this is our king, or is it behold, comma, your, as in Y-O-U apostrophe R-E, so you are king. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, because when I look around, there is a sense of kingship that we operate under self-rule rather than God's rule or the world's rule. So there is a rulership that we live under, and it's not always under God's rule. And so I was thinking through this, and as I was preparing this, I was in my office, I had my big concordance with all the verses throughout the Bible that the word king is mentioned, and in walks an officer, and he just barges through, and he goes, what are you up to, numpty? And here I am, I look at him, I said, I'm just having a look where king comes out in the Bible. And he says to me, if you want to look at a king, just look at me. And I thought, there you go, that's what my thought on Sunday was. Behold, you are a king. And I thought, I'm not too far off. But when I got me further thinking on this whole concept of a kingship, what are the roles and functions that a king does? What do they do? What do they don't do? In 5 weeks' time, we have the coronation of King Charles III. I think 180-odd million Australian dollars they're going to spend on his coronation. But what does he do? Really, what does the guy do? And I don't know why your thoughts are. Some will be here saying, yeah, I'm a monarchist, and some over here going, yeah, I'm a, what's the anti-monarchist, what's the Republican? There you go, you're against them. And you've probably got the rest of you here in the middle going, come on, Wally, next point, I don't really care. Like, and it's that sort of thing. But how we live under a kingship, we can either reject, or we can just passively neglect, or we can just carry on frivolously as if it doesn't happen and make our jokes and carry on. But we all operate under kingship in a certain way. And so why do I bring us to this concept of kingship? Because as we go through Luke's gospel, Luke reveals a battle between two kingdoms, the kingdom of darkness, the kingdom of light. You're either with God or you're against God. They're your two kingdoms. And he asks us to make a decision and identify which side are we on. Are we for God or are we against God? They're the two positions that we have. And so today I want to challenge you with that same thought, to maybe start thinking or rethinking, where do you stand under this concept of kingship that we live under God? It may be for the first time you start thinking, or you may want to reignite this thought, but I hope to take us through some of that. But I want to ask you, which kingdom are you going to identify with? And more importantly, as we live under the ruler of this kingship, how does that work its way out in our daily life? Is it just like a constitutional monarchy with Charles as the king that has no impact on the way that we live from day to day? Or is there a different model that we're going to live and look under? So as you look at today's passage, this is a massive passage that we've got before us. And I'm not going to do it justice, but hopefully we'll get through enough, or I might grab your interest enough to get you looking into it, because there's a lot of rich stuff in here. But we pick up the story with Jesus in the garden, 11 of the 12 disciples, and as he's speaking, a crowd turns up with all these chief priests and elders, and I mean, it's the temple guard, the rulers of the temple guard, with Judas at the front. And so Judas approaches Jesus, kisses him. Then we move from his arrest there through to the house of the high priest. And so as Jesus is in the building, Peter's on the outside. Peter spoke a big game in the earlier verses. He's going to go here, do this, I'll never deny you. And then Jesus' prophecy comes clear, and Peter talked the big game but delivered little. And then we get through to the guards who mock and beat Jesus. And then his trial starts in the morning. He goes off to Pilate, then to Herod, and then back to Pilate again. And at the end, there's no charges that they find. Pilate finds him innocent. He says there's nothing here that he's guilty of. And yet the crowds start crying and screaming out, crucify him, crucify him, and then I'll flog him and let him go. No. Crucify him, crucify him. I'll give you Barabbas, a murderer, an insurrectionist. No, we want him flogged. We want him out, which is what happens. And so when you get to the end of our passage today, in halfway through chapter 23, you have this chaotic scene of mayhem and all this betrayal, injustice and fulfillment all mixed in together. And if you're looking at this for the first time, you might sit here going, what's going on? How can this happen? And as we continue thinking kingship, is this the sort of Jesus, is this the sort of king that you would be willing to submit your life to and follow? If this is the model of kingship Jesus is claiming to hold, is that something we're going to submit to? A king without an army, or maybe a few followers with disciples. One can swing a sword, okay, can lob off the ear of a bloke, but he's got other followers that betray him in such an intimate manner with a kiss for a few coins. I got attempted to get bribed to jail a couple months ago. Second time in 22 years. Sorry? And this guy was serious. I said, buddy, you won't be able to afford my price, even if we do go ahead with it. And he looked at me, I said, $5 million US in my account this afternoon. And I said, then I may even think about it, but he couldn't deliver. But Judas sells him out for a few pieces of silver. And then you have Peter, who's with him along the way, saw pretty much everything that he did and said, and people he ministered to, and all these other things, spoke such a big game, yet here we see him deny him and skulk away. We see a king who's mocked, one who's ridiculed, one who's beaten. And we see someone who's quite silent and passive through this whole process as we get to the end, and he's about to head off to be flogged and then crucified and then finally die. Is that the sort of king you want to follow? Is that the sort of king you want to submit to? Because here doesn't paint that picture of a strong king. When you think of kings in the old days, those monarchs that ruled with power and authority, protected their people, reclaimed lands, they went into battle, they fought for their people, they were victorious. That's our model of kingship. And I think part of the issue we have when we use some of these terms today is that we've lost the import of the old as we come through. You know, like men's ministry these days and kids' ministry with identity. You know, like, I'm glad most of my best days are behind me. But they weren't issues for me. Like identity, you had one of two options, and it was designed for you, it was determined at birth. Today, what is identity? What is it to be a male? What is it to be a king? What is submission and all these other concepts that we wrestle with? But is this the sort of king we're going to submit to and follow? Well, I want to suggest to you, it depends on the lens that we look through, because what you look through, the way you look, will determine what you're going to see. So this isn't a story of a plan gone wrong. This isn't a plan of God's working things out and it's like, wait, wasn't expecting this one. It's not like a movie where you get surprised and where did that come from? This has always been the plan. This is the plan. Jesus is fulfilling God's plan. And as you look at who's in control here, and who thinks they're really in control, you'll see two sides. Because I think the crowd, they think they're pretty much in control. They come up, they arrest, they take, they're the leading ones. Then you've got the chief priests and the elders, you've got Pilate and you've got Herod. I'm pretty sure they're thinking we're in control, we're in the positions of power and authority, but when you look behind the scenes, I really think Jesus is the one that's in control. They come to him as a dangerous criminal, as a thief or a highway bandit, the Greek takes us back to. There was one time I was speaking to an inmate, he was in a top-end Audi R8 or whatever, does stupid amounts of speeds, but that's what they needed to do their jobs and get away from the coppers. Coppers were following them, they pulled into a service station, and there was like three cars, they just rammed into them and smashed this car so they couldn't get away. That's what they needed to do to capture this group of armed criminals about to go off and do some significant crimes. That's how they came to approach Jesus and arrest him as a serious criminal. And he says, like, what are you doing? I'm here in the courts. Like, you could have come at any time. You come like I'm a serious criminal. And then when one of his disciples pulls his sword and chops the ear off, what does he do? He says, look, just settle down. And he grabs the ear and reattaches it. Another miraculous healing. He ministers to this servant of the high priest. Everything he does is part of his plan as we see it being unfolded. And everything he does here gives us an idea of he's not who they think he is. Yet they still think they're in control, and away it goes. But what it does show how hard of heart these guys are, but also how blind they are. Like, you think it through, like, here's a bloke that's just reattached the ear of some bloke, and you want to whisk him off to kill him rather than go, hang on a minute, let me reevaluate my position on who this bloke is. But no, the crowd continues on. Do you ever meet people who say to you, if only I was there in the first century, if only I could see Jesus, then I would believe he walked, and if only I was there. You ever come across those people? Think of these people here. Think of all the people that walked, saw, listened to what Jesus did and said. Saw with their own eyes, yet he changed them not one bit. Had no impact on their lives. And this is where I think the rubber hits the road. They see the works of Jesus and stop there, rather than looking through the works to the glory of who he is. It's like Elon Musk. If you ever listen to any of his podcasts or interviews, there's one in particular where people look at him and go, yeah, I want his money, I want his car, I want his lifestyle, I want all this sort of stuff that he has. And so we look at the works of Elon Musk. But in his interviews, he says, I don't want people to be like me or have what I've got. He goes, I don't sleep a couple hours a night. He goes, my mind's constantly ticking over things. He goes, I'll often miss parties or significant events because my mind's off in different things. Relationally, he's probably a bit off, and yet people will look at what he has and think, I want that. Or a musician or a rock star or a sports or an athlete or whatever. I want what they've got, but without thinking the journey to get here. Do you really want that? If you're a swimmer, do you really want to get up at 3:30 every morning to get to the pool by 4 o'clock to do 2-3 hours before you go to school at the age of 12 or 13? Like, it's crazy. But that's the way we think. We see the works and we stop there. And so I want to encourage us to start looking through the works to the glory behind. There's a different picture here. John Owen sums it up. He's an old English minister and theologian. Back in the 16th, 17th century. In one of his books, he says, after Moses had seen the works of God, which were great and marvelous, he still found himself unsatisfied. Therefore, he prayed that God would show him his glory. He knew that the ultimate rest, blessing, and satisfaction of the soul is not seeing the works of God, but the glory of God himself. So if you go back to Exodus 33, the real blessing, satisfaction, and rest of the soul isn't in seeing the works of God, but the glory of God himself. The Israelites saw the works of God, yet had little impact on their lives. Judas and the disciples saw everything Jesus did. They saw the miracles, they heard the teaching, they witnessed Jesus minister and operate love in action. So if seeing works, then you would expect these disciples to be super disciples. If it's just seeing, there's got to be more to it. It isn't what they see or how much they see of God's works. The question is, do they see his glory in the works? And for you and I, do we see the glory in the works? When you see the sun come up, what do you see? When you go to the beach and you see the waves, you walk on the sand, what do you see? I think my wife sees annoyance as the sand blows on her legs. Or are you reminded of Bible verses? Do you see the power of the one who makes the ways, the one who rises that sun and sets it every day? Like, as we look beyond, we see a different perspective. When we hit verse 53, we get the next part of the plan in this opening bit. Where are we? The part where honor, your hour has come, where evil is going to reign. That's the reality here. The moment in God's plan that allows the forces of evil to work out their will. The time of rejection, the time of darkness, the time of evil being played out. And if you're reading this and it's a surprise to you, it shouldn't come as a surprise. Through Luke's gospel, if you're reading from start to finish, you'll hit verse 51 in chapter 9. You'll see Jesus heading on his merry ministry way, and then he gets to verse 51. We read that from there he resolutely sets out to Jerusalem, for the hour wasn't far off when he was to be taken to heaven. Three times he predicts the Son of Man is going to be arrested and flogged and then killed. Verse 10 of chapter 9, and he comes that the Son of Man has come to seek and save that which was lost. Seek and save that which was lost. That's us. He's come to seek us and to save us. And all of that's on top of the Old Testament prophecies that we come across. And so when we hit the morning, we see Jesus before this council, the Sanhedrin, the bunch of Jewish rulers and leaders. And they ask him a couple questions. Are you the Messiah? Are you the Son of God? And when you look at these passages, are you the Messiah? Are you the one we're expecting? Are you the Son of God? And he responds in a way here that doesn't really pick up the force. The Greeks uses the same words, but when you read John's Gospel, chapter 8, where he says, are you then the Son of God? He replies, you say that I am. In John, he records it as, I am. Which takes us back to the Old Testament that these guys knew. Remember when the Israelites were being held captive? And then Moses is called to go and release them. And then as he's thinking through, what if they ask who sends me? I am sends me. God's name. God's the one sending him to release. And these Jewish leaders picked that up. That's why the chief priest tears his clothes that we read in Matthew's gospel and then shouts, he's blasphemous. There's a lot going on behind the scenes here, but things to ponder up as we finish. Pilate at the end, he asks why. Why crucify an innocent man? That's the position of the crowd. And the longer you live in this world, you'll see that this world has people that are filled with opinion, but the investigation or work behind their opinions at times is a bit lacking. I experience it almost every day in the jail. You have lawyers and doctors and all these other people, inmates you think they are. We have a few ones that actually are. We've got one doctor at the moment. But everyone's an expert. Everyone will argue, or generally argue with me, based on an opinion. And then when I push into them a little bit, you can see it starts to falter a bit. And so I say to them, all right, look, how about you go away, do your groundwork, come back so we can have an intelligent and informed discussion. And most times they don't come back because it's just based on opinion. Our real issues need to be thought through, not just reacted to. So when we think through things, I want us firstly to think, and this is one of my hobby horses. I don't think we think a great deal as a society, and possibly even as a church. I haven't spoken to a great deal of you, but I think when we do think, we need to think both biblically and theologically. So when we think biblically, we let our thinking be shaped and disciplined by what the Bible teaches. And we ask Paul's question in situations that we find ourselves, where Paul says, what does Scripture say? And so we go to the Scriptures and see, what does the Bible say about whatever situation we're finding ourselves in or we're working through and processing? And that should be our question as well. And then once we determine a bit of that, we start thinking theologically and we think through the Scriptures point to the one behind. So how do we take this thinking and relate it to all that we think and do? How do we relate our thinking to God wherever we find ourselves? For most of the guys in jail, I tell them, your best thinking got you here in jail. Our best thinking has got us here to where we are today. Your best thinking has got you to where you are. We need to think, and we need to think a bit more intently. And when I push people on this whole concept of how do you view people from a biblical perspective or a theological perspective. So how do you view people, and then how do you work with them? And I've used this illustration before, but Helen's greeting to me and Steve when we first came here is a classic example. We rock up, Helen's on the welcoming. First words that come from her mouth on our first ever encounter, what brings you two big beefers here? Classic, I loved it. And I was, sign me up for membership after that. And then, where do you come from? And I'm thinking, this is going to be interesting. And so I said, yeah, look, I'm from Glenmore Park. And then the bloke I was with says, yeah, I'm from jail. And I went, oh, didn't bat an eyelid. Great to have you here, welcome. Came in, after the service came and followed us up. Like, there's someone who sees a person in jail as a person. The in jail bit is almost irrelevant. So here's someone who sees someone who's worthy of dignity, love, and respect, because that's the way God sees them, and they see them. And then they operate out of that. And so it was a great blessing and a great encouragement to be met that way. So as we understand God extends grace and love and compassion, that's what we're called to do. And as we look at this crowd, the priests, the elders, the Pilate, Herod, all these guys, I don't think they thought too much about this. They knew it because they reacted to the Old Testament. They knew what they wanted to do, but their lives weren't shaped by the Old Testament, by what they saw that Jesus did. They saw his works. They weren't operating from the glory behind it. And when you do think biblically and you think theologically, you're in a better position to look through the event, the circumstance you're in, to see the glory behind it. Don't get me wrong, it's still going to be hard as you're sitting there in this mess, but you're going to be seeing behind it. Not wondering, where is God? Why has God left me? As you look through, you're going to know, no, he's there with you. You're not on your own. God's at work, even though we don't see it. So when we say, behold your king, I haven't seen Jesus in life, in real life. One day I will when I stand before him. But until then, I've got to wrestle with this as I journey through life. That's why I enjoy sunsets and sunrises and the beach, because I can look through them and see the power of God and attribute that to him. Not the great serpent or this or that or Mother Earth or all this sort of stuff. I know the living God's the one that's behind it all. And in his word, as I engage it and read it, I see glimpses of beauty. I see the worth that Jesus has. And I see that everything that this world is offering me isn't going to deliver what it says it will. Because it's not going to offer me the saving grace that Jesus does. And knowing that, I want to see more of that glory. I want to stand and see and behold that with greater force, greater enjoyment. I've been married for 34 years, 32 as a Christian, and it was about a year ago, and your mate says to me, "Oh, geez, that's a long time. How do you go being married to the one woman for all that time?" And I remember asking my mum the same thing when I was a heap younger. But the more you walk with someone, the more you journey with someone, the more you grow and experience and appreciate their beauty. The more I've walked with Jen for the last 34 years and have seen God at work in her life, in all the areas that she works in her day job, plus the ministries here at church, is phenomenal. And I can sit back and go, yeah, she's a strong, powerful, confident woman, all that sort of stuff, and go, yeah, you go, girl. Or I can go, you know what? Lord, thank you. Thank you for giving me such a great person to journey through life with, one that I don't deserve, one that I frustrate more, I think, probably less as I've been getting older. Yeah, oh, there you go. Hey? Good job, Will. But the more you journey, the more you look through to see the reality. And that's my encouragement to us today, so that as we behold our King, we won't just hold on to these works. We'll look beyond to the God who's behind. I want to transition now into communion with the few minutes we've got left. But before I do, any thoughts, any questions anyone wants to raise out of that? I know we don't do this, but I normally do this in jail. No? All right.